Welcome to the exciting world of television, a wholly new field for you to begin to learn in. Sound a little excited, James.
Sound less excited, Roger. That's why we're redoing it, because of what you did. It's Thriller Week on Siskel and Ebert at the Movies, and we've got three new ones.
And the movies, not at the movies. And that's why we're doing it this time.
How do you think it went without Gene tonight?
Nobody interrupted me, except for you.
Yeah. But Gene, now
I miss Gene.
Gene looking down on this tonight is saying to himself, "Aha, you see? You need me down there, you lousy bastard."
I do.
From Tuscaloosa, Alabama, this is Aspect Radio. I'm Corey Kraft.
And I'm Ben Flanagan. Welcome to another episode of the show. We have a lot to discuss. We're going to talk about Harmony Korine's new film, Spring Breakers, which is somehow playing nationally in a fairly wide release. And we're going to talk about our favorite action movies in light of new action movies, G.I. Joe, Retaliation, and Olympus Has Fallen, hitting theaters. But first, anyone who would download or listen to a movie podcast like this one or any other movie podcast knows now that legendary movie critic and Chicago Sun-Times writer Roger Ebert passed away this afternoon. The Chicago Sun-Times announced that this afternoon on Twitter. And much to our dismay, this news came rather suddenly, even though Roger Ebert himself wrote in his final online journal entry that he would be taking what he called a leave of presence and would be writing selected movie reviews, fewer movie reviews, as he put it, because his health had taken a turn for the worse, as it were, and the cancer, which he had been fighting for such a long time of the latter part of his life, had sort of come back in his body. And little did we know that things were as dire as they were, given the fight that he had fought for so long up to this point. And just 2 days later, we got the news that he passed away. And obviously, we've seen just an outpouring of condolences and tributes in mere hours since the news was announced, Corey. But I just want to get your reaction to it as soon as you heard it, and now that you've had some time to think about it.
Well, you know, I got the news when I was about halfway through one of the movies we're talking about today, Olympus Has Fallen. And, you know, I wrote some thoughts that I've published on my blog at the Tuscaloosa News, but there's something fitting, I think, about that. Getting that news in that setting, you know, when I'm seeing a movie to review on this podcast, and, you know, really the only reason that I even do this, and the only reason I think that a generation of film writers do this, is because they were inspired in their love of movies and their love of writing by, in no small part, by Roger Ebert. You know, there are some other influential critics as well, but I think that Ebert, being the critic with the most presence and the most presence in pop culture for sure, and the most likely to be syndicated in your local newspaper and the most likely to be seen on television, you know, there's something about that sort of opened up this world of film analysis and just love of the movies to, you know, a generation of people our age and older. And the fact is, you know, apart from him being one of the most exposed critics, you read his writing and it's quite clear he was one of the best, one of the very best. He's the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for film criticism and for criticism, and he deserves it. And his writing, is just day in and day out, when he still wrote regularly and just on any subject and any film he loved, any film he didn't love, it's just captivating. And it's just a truly inspirational voice, I think, that we've lost today.
You know, and I think it's fitting on Tuesday, in a way, what he wrote on his journal, because, I mean, in a sense, he wrote his own obituary.
Right.
He looked back throughout his life and recalled how long he had been writing and his love of films and how he was sorry that he had to stop writing as much as he has been in the latter part of his career. But honestly, what a beautiful way to go out, to be frank. And maybe he knew some, obviously, he probably knew something that we did not. And his own obituary that he essentially wrote is even better than anyone that anyone else out there could. And you're seeing these moving tributes by film critics, Like Scott Tobias has a really nice one out there now. I see now that Todd McCarthy has one up for the Hollywood Reporter, and I'm sure we'll see many, many more. You can find them locally even, because like you said, this is a guy who, you know, he tapped into movies unlike anybody, and he was able to reach mainstream audiences through film criticism like nobody has been able to since he and his colleague on television, obviously Gene Siskel with the Chicago Tribune, were able to do. And I think about the first time I was exposed to Roger Ebert, and today obviously I've been trying to think back to what that was, and it probably was via television. You know, I grew up obviously as a film fan. My dad was a big film fan, and he noticed that obviously we had that gene too, my brother Graham and I, and he knew that we loved watching movies, but we loved watching people talk about movies and reading people talk about movies. And he showed us this show Sneak Previews with Michael Medved and Jeffrey Lyons, which was unheard of when we were kids, these two guys on television talking about movies. But then after we had seen a few episodes of that show, we came upon Siskel and Ebert. We finally were exposed to them, and we saw that there was this better version of that kind of broadcast, and it was great, not just because they were talking about movies, but because of their chemistry and because of their knowledge. And these were guys who were like us, but you know, we were younger. They just had that kind of interest in it, and so it was good to see sort of some of your own kind with shared interests on television. And you grew up, and it became Ebert and Roper, and that was a little less available in Tuscaloosa anyway.
Right.
I think at some point it started playing on like Saturday morning at 2 a.m. or Sunday morning at 2 a.m.
Yeah.
And that would be infrequent. But I think back to their Tonight Show appearances where they would appear together, and on Letterman too. They were hilarious. They had incredible interplay. Their tempers with each other, obviously, that has been immortalized now with this YouTube video of them sort of taking shots at each other during just a basic promo for their show. And it's hilarious, but awfully telling at times. But you think about his reviews too. I mean, every single Friday, up to this point, honestly, every single Friday, it was a routine of mine to go to RogerEbert.com or ChicagoSunTimes.com/Ebert and read what he had to say about new releases, because this is a guy who just had the passion early in his life. He won a Pulitzer Prize relatively early in his career, I guess you could say. And he never lost the passion for it. He never lost the drive to continue writing about it. And I mean, the volume of what he wrote and the quality of what he wrote just grew as he got older and as he became afflicted with cancer and these other physical ailments. And because of that, I think he's so much more of an inspiration professionally. Personally, I would say he's an inspiration. He's so much bigger than just a film critic. And I mean, he had so many great things to say about movies, but I just think, yeah, as a writer, as somebody who just wants to be better, not only writing, but just, you know, having something to say and being honest about movies and fair, I think he's an amazing figure. And, you know, I look to his books too, The Great Movies, his autobiography that he released not too long ago. There's just so much out there. And even Reviving at the Movies with Michael Phillips and A.O. Scott, it was just good to see that he still cared about it, and he still cared enough to give folks like that, people who we respect as fans and as critics, a chance to go back on television and talk seriously about movies.
Yeah, and his writing, especially in the latter part of his career, after he experienced the difficulties and with the cancer that he had, I guess was diagnosed with in 2006, lost his jaw, lost his ability to speak, and just the personal essays and blog entries that followed that in the last, I guess, 8 or so years were always really still entertaining, sometimes very moving, always warm and perceptive, and just he's a real writer's writer, I guess you can say. But not only in the way that, you know, he inspired as a film critic, but also just as a man and as a good person, you could read the warmth, and that's why, I mean, I think that's why this hits people so hard, even though so few of us ever had the chance to meet him or actually even interact with him. Just you get to know what kind of person he was through his writing. He was such an intimate writer and such a seemingly good person through the writing that he did. It's a tough loss.
Yeah, it really is. This one actually really hurts today.
Yeah, it does.
It does. And, you know, you think about names like Pauline Kael, Andrew Saris. Ebert's got to be up there, right? I mean, he's in the pantheon of film critics.
Just for the sake of bringing it to the people, I would think.
Yeah, and not just because he's the most famous either, right. Because he established himself as that because of his the forum, I guess, that he had at one point being on television, even though it was public television for a while. The quality was there too. I mean, this guy, like you said, it being a writer's writer, it didn't get any better. And, you know, it would be fun for me to read his reviews and see all of the different, like, factual things he would get wrong in his reviews, just like character names or just like very minor things. That became something I look forward to. But God knows, as long as he's been doing it, how much goodwill do you need to earn to where you can get away with something like that?
I mean, just the fact of the matter is, like, even if you disagree with what he says about any movie, and I often did personally, it's still just a pleasure to read. It's still just a really perceptive, more often than not, piece of film writing. And it's not like he was ever baseless with his film criticism. More often than not, there were a couple times, I think, infamously, that people seemed to think that he got it totally wrong. But more often than not, I'd say that he backed his thoughts up. And even if I didn't agree with it, it's one of those things that's just the pleasure of the prose is so strong that you can't help but just keep coming back for more.
Yeah, and he taught you lessons that way too. If you have an argument for something ridiculous, back it up.
Yeah.
Write it out. You know, convince people. And I don't know that I know anybody else on earth who would give The Cell 4 stars or Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets 4 stars. But Ebert was that guy. And I mean, you might feel that way too, Corey, but I'm just saying, like, he would come out with these outrageous 4-star reviews for things, and you would just think, what in the hell is this man thinking or smoking?
I mean, sometimes, though, that takes you, you know, when I read those things that after I see a movie and I don't like it and see that he really did like it and really did find something to value in it, it almost causes you to do a double take and think, well, what is it that I didn't like, and you know, maybe there is some value here that I overlooked. And it's just the strength of the writing and the strength of the arguments draw you to sort of, I guess, rethink your own position and figure out why you feel the way you feel, even if you don't agree with it, and even if you're not going to change your mind. Just, I guess, in opposition, you become a stronger critic by learning how to make the counter argument. And that's one thing that I think is valuable about this show, about what we do, you know, especially when we disagree, finding out why we disagree and sort of making the case to one another, even if neither of us will, you know, change our minds, there's still something valuable in that. And I think Ebert did that to, I don't know, a generation of people, causing them to think about movies in a critical way, and a generation of filmmakers whose careers he bolstered with positive reviews, and you know, indie filmmakers whose films he championed and got exposure to. You know, think about something like Hoop Dreams in 1994, which would not be the institution, the documentary institution that it is now, if not for the single-handed advocacy of Roger Ebert, or, you know, countless other movies like that. You know, his word makes or breaks reputations. If you think back to his infamous Brown Bunny review and his tiff with Vincent Gallo, you know, say what you will about the Brown Bunny, but you don't see Vincent Gallo, for whatever reason, making more movies, I guess, as an artistic presence these days. I wouldn't say that's entirely because of Roger Ebert, but he brought the attention to these little movies, for good or ill, and for mostly for good, almost entirely mostly for good, and really made people's careers.
Yeah, and anybody who writes movie reviews, be it on a blog or for a newspaper, anybody who hosts a movie podcast or a video cast and puts something on YouTube these days, they don't owe just something to Roger Ebert. They owe a lot to Roger Ebert, and he will truly be missed. And we're going to do something a little differently this week. We usually have parting shots at the end of the show, but while we're on this topic of Roger Ebert and paying tribute to this man, we want to invite our AspectRadioFilmNerds.com colleagues to share a few thoughts on the passing of Roger Ebert.
For Film Nerds and Aspect Radio, this is Graham Flanagan in New York. Today we all got the sad news that film critic Roger Ebert passed away due to complications from his ongoing cancer struggle. It's hard to put into words what a huge loss this is for the film criticism community and even the film community itself. I've been a fan of Ebert since my early teens when I first got internet access, and suntimes.com/Ebert quickly became one of the four or five websites I checked on a regular basis. It's obvious that Ebert, along with his former partner Gene Siskel, made movie criticism popular, and no doubt inspired thousands of the movie critics that we read each day via Rotten Tomatoes and now Twitter. But the thing I'll appreciate the most was his willingness to find the good in all types of movies. He would rhapsodize about dumb action movies with the same amount of passion that he would bestow on the most austere Ingmar Bergman movie. That, to me, is the key to being a solid and trustworthy critic. You have to be willing to like anything. You can't turn your nose up at material that seems at face value to be too dumbed down or mainstream. The same Ebert who inexplicably gave Under Siege: Dark Territory a glowing review is the same guy who wouldn't shut up about how great Synecdoche, New York was. If your spectrum of cinematic interest doesn't mirror that of Roger Ebert, then just hang it up. You're not the real thing. Roger Ebert certainly was. I think his greatest lasting contribution will be his Great Movies book series, which should be required reading for any young cinephile in training. My only disappointment for Ebert is that he lived his entire life without understanding or appreciating the majesty of M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. Ebert foolishly and irresponsibly lambasted the modern masterpiece on The Tonight Show and in his own review. I think that if he gave it another chance, he might come around. Let's just hope they have Netflix and movie heaven. For Film Nerds and Aspect Radio, this is Graham Flanagan in New York.
Hey, this is Craig in Nashville with a parting shot on yesterday's big announcement of the passing of the legendary film critic Roger Ebert. And though my opinions on particular films never really lined up that well with Roger Ebert's, it was the publication of his and Gene Siskel's top 10 list from 1969 through 1998 that I was able to peruse to find ideas on old films that I needed to watch that I hadn't seen before. And that was a really good source to find that. I was able to watch a lot of good movies that way, especially the 1985 Holocaust documentary Shoah, which was excluded from his top 10 list because it was so good that it belonged in an upper echelon in and of itself. But what I appreciate most about what Roger Ebert left behind is his wonderful and insightful commentary on Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, which is an absolute must-see for any film fan. He goes scene by scene, explaining all the hidden little gems and nuances within the film itself, and gives backstory and meaning to the making of the film and what was happening at the time of the making of the film. And Ebert sheds light on a lot of the new and innovative things Orson Welles was doing to make this film. All the little breakdown of sets and optical illusions and cool things done with the lenses and the special effects. He sheds light on all of that, and it's an incredible thing to go revisit, and it's, I think, the best thing Roger Ebert did.
Hey guys, it's Ben Stark up here in Huntsville. I just wanted to weigh in quickly on the passing of Roger Ebert. It's tremendously sad. I guess nobody is extremely surprised since he has been struggling with health problems for seems like the last decade or so. But along with everybody else on the planet Earth, I think, at least in our generation, Roger Ebert was my introduction to kind of film analysis long before film school or long before the internet or just kind of DVD commentaries. I grew up reading Roger Ebert reviews in my local newspaper. He was the only film critic that I could ever remember getting published in the Huntsville Times. And one thing that I think is always going to be Roger Ebert's legacy, at least to me, is his ability to watch a film on the film's own terms. He could rate The Phantom as many stars as something like Casino, or he just had a knack for seeing a film, what the film was going for, and then judging it based on that, rather than going in with preconceived notions. He really is a legend. I don't think anybody is going to dispute his place among film criticism, and I don't think film criticism is going to be the same without him. So, R.I.P. Roger Ebert.
All I know is I'm not going to sit here another day.
Spring break.
How are we going to get enough money?
I don't know.
We're the only ones still here.
Spring break.
I'm tired of seeing the same thing.
Spring break.
It's your chance to see something different.
Spring break.
Just get the cash.
Pretend like it's a video game.
We can do this.
Spring break.
Hide your body, pop.
This is Megan Fleming, ladies and gentlemen.
pants sagging low like the
yaw. What a magic place, y'all. You can change who you are, y'all. Bikinis and big booties, y'all. That's what life is about.
Who are you?
My name's Aileen.
Why are you here?
I saw y'all in there. They like nice people.
Come on, y'all. Why acting suspicious?
I knew y'all was special from the moment I saw you. It's written on your faces.
Because I just have a really, really bad feeling about this.
Let's cause some trouble now.
Break, break, bitches!
I got my dark tanning oil. Lay out by the pool.
This is the American dream, y'all. Spring break.
Y'all want to die tonight?
Spring break.
Get down!
You scared, aren't you?
Spring break forever.
Spring break forever, bitches.
We are back, and in theaters now, or for a short time in Tuscaloosa anyway, Corey. I think it's leaving on Friday, as a matter of fact.
Is it?
Harmony Korine's latest feature film, and he only has a few of them, Spring Breakers, playing in Tuscaloosa. And that truly blew my mind as a film fan, to be honest with you. I mean, I was relatively familiar with Korine growing up. I'd seen Kids at a very young age, right when it came out on video.
Really?
Yeah. And yeah. I rented it from this video store in town, which used to be a baseball card shop called Three Up, Three Down. It was a baseball card shop, but it happened to rent movies out. And for whatever reason, they didn't really care necessarily what they rented out to whom. So children could come into these stores and rent movies like Kids. And thank goodness my brother got away with it, and I tagged along, and we watched Kids by Larry Clark. And that was written by Korine when I think he was about 19 years old.
Yeah, that's right.
And I got to say, you know, it was something else. I'd never seen anything like it at that age. I can't remember how old I was. I probably, when was that, 1995 when that came out?
Something like that.
So I was probably 11 or 12 when I first saw that movie.
It's a good age.
Yeah, it was
exposed to a Larry Clark movie.
Honestly, it is. I mean, it was an education. Let's put it that way. You know, it works about as well as the D.A.R.E. program might, or watching Trainspotting did when I was in theaters. Yeah. Never would touch a needle after that. But you at least got a sense of what this guy's voice was like, because he made a movie called Gummo after that, his feature film directing debut, and Julian Donkey Boy. He went on to make Trash Humpers, which came out a few years ago. These are films that were less accessible to us, at least in Alabama, and pre-Netflix anyway. Once Great. Netflix came around, these became a little bit more available, and they became these cult classics of sorts. And Harmony Korine definitely had a following, but there was also this legion of people who just didn't really understand what this guy did. His films are art films, and they might have a lot to say, but it's hard sort of like sifting through what people would consider art trash to find the meaning.
Well, he traffics in the grotesque, I think, is, you could say, particularly with Gummo and Julian Donkey Boy. I haven't seen the latter. I did see Gummo, and I have seen Kids, and count me in among the Harmony Korine skeptics, at least up to a point.
Well, yeah, up to a point perhaps a couple of weeks ago when Spring Breakers came to Tuscaloosa. And look, the press for this movie was abundant because it involved these Disney princesses, Vanessa Hudgens and Selena Gomez, starring in their first R-rated movies together in alongside James Franco. And it also stars this Pretty Little Liars co-star Ashley Benson and Korine's wife, Rachel Korine, I believe is her name, in this hard R, drug, gun-running, nightmare spring break fantasy. And this movie involves these four Kentucky girls, I believe is where they're from. I don't really know.
Tennessee, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
It, just judging by the presence of Jeff Jarrett as a
preacher. Ruin that for people. But, I mean, if they haven't seen it at this point, that was a big moment for me, especially growing up as a wrestling fan. But that was fantastic. But these four girls who were bored in their small southern town who want to go down to St. Petersburg, of all places, Florida, to just have a great time during spring break, get buck wild. And they find that they don't have enough money to do that. So what do they resort to? They rob a chicken shack or a chicken restaurant, I guess what would be like the local Guthrie's here in Tuscaloosa, and they get enough money to where they can hop aboard a party bus and head down there. They have a great time, and they get busted for drug possession. And when they get bailed out of jail by this drug-dealing, gun-running weirdo played by James Franco, this guy named Alien, he sort of hires them, as he's bought them now, to commence committing more crimes for him. And that's sort of like how this plot plays out, but it doesn't really play out as straightforward as that might sound. But after watching this, do you understand now why it might have played nationally the way that it did? Do you think that Harmony Korine has made a movie that might appeal to the masses, even if it does star these A-list young people in this sun-baked, alcohol-drenched, drug-infused spring break nightmare? Do you think that this is something that can appeal to a lot of people, or are you still flabbergasted as to why this movie went wide?
Well, it might get them into theaters, but a movie like this that's marketed exclusively to the millennial generation as being like a fun party movie that ends up being this much of a nightmare and criticism of that sort of party scene, I don't imagine they're going to be too happy about it once they get in there and see it. Not to mention, it's an art film through and through, from construction to just fundamentally. There's a way to tell this story in a straightforward, unironic, unadorned way that might be more appealing to, I guess, the audience that you're referring to who would see this movie in sort of multiplexes. But I would not think that the average, you know, I actually hesitate to say that because I don't know what people like anymore. I guess I think that this movie might be a little bit too critical of the lifestyle that many people think that it's celebrating when they go in to see it. But, you know, I don't know. Anecdotally, the audience that I saw it with didn't care for it. A lot of walkouts of young people. This isn't people like coming into a theater and suddenly getting outraged by the hard drinking and hard drug use and nudity present by these college students. They knew what they were getting in for. But the presentation of it with this sort of mantra repetition of dialogue and the editing, the non-linear editing and the non-linear storytelling, I think drove some people up the wall. For me, it really made this movie. This feels like a Steven Soderbergh treatment of Spring Break. And while I think that he might be a little bit more tempered with some of the things that Harmony Korine is not tempered with, like the almost Pilgrim's Progress style naming of characters, I think that, you know, you've got Soderbergh's trademark nonlinear storytelling and even a Cliff Martinez score. And the whole time I'm watching this movie, I think, you know, this is something that could have fit in between Out of Sight and The Limey in terms of style. But in terms of content, it's just totally out there. Totally nightmarish and suffocating and celebratory and all sorts of contradictory feelings, because I don't know that Korine is necessarily judging his characters for what they do, even though I think at some points he kind of might be, and even though I think at some points it's kind of hard not to read that. But there are other points where it seems like a genuine or at least distanced look at this culture. And you know, given Korine's past work, like Kids, sort of a depiction, albeit exaggerated, of the worst tendencies of his generation, I don't think that that's too far off. But I love this movie. I have a feeling you do too.
You mentioned Kids, and you mentioned judging the characters and these experiences that he puts them through. It's a learning process,
right,
for young people. And even though this is this nightmare of a movie and a bit of a fantasy, I think that it's some of the most brilliant commentary on youth culture that I've seen in a long time.
Well, the one thing that I keep thinking of and going back to is this repeated dialogue. I guess it's a phone conversation home by one of the girls. I think it might be Vanessa Hudgens' character, but they're, you know, with the exception of Selena Gomez, all fairly interchangeable. She keeps saying about how great of a time they're having and how it's this transcendent experience. Now they're using it to find themselves. And this, of course, is cut with these images of just this drunken nonsense and public vomiting and public urination and just like all of this like horrible, destructive behavior. And, you know, there's part of me that's like, well, you know, maybe this is a film exploring about how this destructive behavior is just inherently part of the youth experience and how this is just something that that kids do. But also there's just something about the juxtaposition of those images and that indicates that Harmony Korine is quite aware of how full of crap that whole thing is. And that's where I lean, actually.
No, absolutely. I'm with you there. This is Harmony Korine sort of pointing his finger at them and saying, look, you're stupid in a way, and judging them to an extent, but trying to teach them a lesson at the same time. Mm-hmm. Because I think simultaneously, he's celebrating youth culture too.
Right.
And how much fun they are able to have and how sort of like purely motivated by fun they are. And that's something that anybody can experience and anybody can share and celebrate. And you have this sequence that he sort of keeps cutting back to of the height, the extreme of how much fun that they're having at the beach. Mm-hmm. And this is how great spring break can be. And this is what it represents in our minds. This is one of the easiest calls I've had to make in a long time, seeing a movie, to be honest with you. This is a great film to me. I genuinely love this movie. I feel that seriously about this. Just talk about the opening sequence of this movie, which is just this. You can say nightmare. I think some people would say fantasy that they probably have about going down to the beach and having that kind of good time. I mean, you're talking about people in high school and grown people who probably share that fantasy. But I remember once the credits are over, you hear this Skrillex track that we're very familiar with at this point start to like fade up. And once it cuts to what it cuts to in this montage that we get when this thing kicks into high gear, I remember thinking, oh my God, he's doing it. You know, he really is. And not he's just showing us this sequence of nudity and debauchery and just fun in the sun and drinking and doing drugs and that kind of thing. It's more than just this music video. This is just this perfect, to me, representation of youth culture and the kind of time they want to have and are having in many cases, especially during spring break, but also what it can devolve to so quickly once they make one bad decision. It's so funny to me, this again, you talk about the commentary this movie's kind of making. Once these girls make their bad decision and they get locked up in the slammer, instead of spending two nights in jail, they're given the choice of spending two nights in this, you know, little jail cell together, or they can be bailed out by this moron drug dealer played by James Franco. They make the decision to go with this guy instead of sitting in a cell for a couple of days and getting off, you know, scot-free in a way.
I want to back you up a little bit because the first bad decision happened long before they even got to the beach. And that's what I think, that's one of the most cutting things I think about this movie is Corinne sort of illustrating the fine line between pursuing pleasure and wanting to have a good time and total sociopathy, which I think at least three of these girls cross over.
Two and a half.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're so, I guess, set on this totemic idea of spring break and this ideal, as you said, is illustrated in the opening montage, that they're willing to commit armed robbery to get it. And from there, there's not much of a downward slope from there because there's only so far you can go past that point. But James Franco's character, Alien, is it.
Yeah.
This cornrow wearing, grill wearing, white rapper drug dealer guy who speaks in these drawling, like hip hop style, like just his life is one hip hop affectation from, you know, the now infamous look at my shit scene to, you know, basically everything he says and does, and these girls buy into it, or most of them do for whatever reason. That's when the movie kicks into high gear for me. I was enjoying it quite a bit, but Franco really kicks it up to the next level. I think this is probably one of his best performances, and just the sort of, I guess, really exaggerated sandbox the movie starts playing in after that point, while still not being entirely exaggerated, is not something I'd call fun necessarily, but just enhances this nightmarish quality the movie already had been building.
Yeah, you want to get out of there. You know, you want to leave as soon as possible, kind of like one of the characters does at one point in the movie. You never see her again.
Right.
But you also can't stop watching it, and it's so much fun at the same time. It really reminded me a lot of Oliver Stone's filmmaking, some of his better sort of like rock star filmmaking that he was doing, I guess, in the 90s especially.
Natural Born Killers,
The Doors, even JFK to some extent. The style of it.
The
swapping of film stocks and filters and things like that. But it's not just for the sake of style. It's for the sake of perspective, and I think that he does it incredibly effectively. But you think about, again, these decisions that they make. These girls are dangerous. They're dangerous to themselves, and they do affect others too. It's like when Alien comes to bail them out. Three of them have
trepidations at first about it, him saying, hey guys, I bailed you out. Why not? Why don't you get in my car and come with me? No, that's not what we want to do here. But one of them, Harmony Korine's wife, starts to walk towards the passenger door of his car, and he says, she's got the right idea. And they're like, what are you doing? Are you crazy? But she's just going to do it just because. They're right down there. Why not? We're out of jail. Let's do this thing.
One of the things I read about this movie in the interviews that Harmony Korine has given is the sort of inspiration to even start this project, this fascination with how kids will travel to St. Petersburg and to the Gulf Coast during spring break and basically destroy a bunch of stuff, do a bunch of drugs, get drunk for a week, and then come back and pretend that nothing's happened. And I think that that mindset sort of echoes through what these girls, or how these girls behave. They're so put off by their humdrum college life that they're willing to go to any length, I guess, to have this experience of spring break. Never mind that the experience of spring break that they're having is horrifying and negative and harmful to themselves and others.
But they have different ideas of what spring break is. Mm. Spring break has a different meaning to almost every single character in this movie. You hear that those words said over and over by characters in this. Spring break, it means so much to me. We can get away. We don't have to be ourselves. We can get away from this podunk town and this meaningless existence that we have in Kentucky or Tennessee or wherever we are, and we can just be here and be free, and we should do this forever. And then you have James Franco spouting it off in narration and with them over and over. Spring break, y'all. Spring break to him means I get to recruit these four girls to be my little crime spree partners in this new gang I have, and I can, you know, rob spring breakers with them. They have quite the resume up to this point. They're useful. And what I think is interesting is that Selena Gomez in particular has this monologue while they're in this pool, kind of like what I was just talking about, how they can get away and she wants to do this forever. Mm-hmm. She wants her cake and she wants to eat it too, right? Well, there are a couple of characters who do that, and they invest and they make the commitment to it. But then you have the Selena Gomez character who wants that, but when she's thrust into the other side of town, I guess in St. Petersburg, once they've been bailed out and recruited by an alien, she becomes uncomfortable like that when she's hanging out with a different sect of people. For a matter of minutes, probably, and she becomes uncomfortable. And this isn't her idea of spring break. And it's fairly harmless up to that point, too. They're hanging out at a pool hall. Some guy hits on her.
Yeah, it's not like overtly threatening.
But she wants out of there.
Yeah. And you know, there's an expectation, I think, set up by the first, let's say, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, first part of the movie, that character is going to be the audience surrogate and that it's going to go in a situation where she's pushing back against her friends. And she's the voice of reason as the situation escalates. Well, it doesn't turn out that way. We'll just say that. And that's a really interesting decision because, you know, her name, Faith, leads you to believe, and her Christian faith, as portrayed in the movie, leads you to believe that this is going to go in a sort of, well, in the sort of direction that you've seen a bunch of times. And it doesn't. In fact, the rug is sort of pulled out from under you at about halfway through the movie, and it becomes a very different, more uninhibited sort of thing, which is a really interesting creative choice.
But like you said, it sort of kicks into fifth gear
yeah.
at that point. It really goes a place that you don't really see movies go right now. And this movie reminds me a lot of the Hype Williams movie Belly. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with it?
I haven't seen it.
It came out in like 97, 98. It reminds me of that in terms of this hip-hop culture that I think that it's exploring and that it's infusing into its style. And it has all these music video devices and affectations uh-huh. that it uses. And it sort of has this plot that's just enough of a plot, but it gives the filmmaker a chance to just sort of be free and uninhibited as a stylist. But I think that there is enough plot and there is enough being said in this movie to justify all of the stylistic choices that Harmony Korine makes. And honestly, I didn't think he was capable of a lot of what he does in this movie. You know, we're used to that sort of like grainy, gritty style yeah. that we've seen in films of his in the past, but there is stuff technically that to me is on the level of like Michael Bay, Michael Mann, again, Oliver Stone, that I think in terms of technical proficiency, Harmony Korine really pulls it off. I was genuinely impressed with how this movie looked, how it sounded, how it was cut together. And it's not in a way where you feel like you're having a headache, where it is sensory overload, but I think that that totally just completely adds to the experience rather than detracts from it.
Yeah, I agree. And I'll go back to the Soderbergh comparison, if only because of the editing and in the Cliff Martinez score. But you're right. I mean, it is the sort of, I guess, guerrilla style, really stylized thing that I certainly didn't expect to see, the sort of neon washed presentation that gets more colorful, oddly, as it goes on, away from the beach and away from the proper spring break, and I guess more into this exaggerated music video style nightmare of the sort of off-season nightlife. And of course, you've got hip-hop artist Gucci Mane as a rival drug dealer, I guess, to the James Franco character, which kind of brings up this layer, I guess, of the authenticity of Gucci Mane versus the like hilarious affectation of James Franco's Alien, sort of black culture being co-opted by this like scrawny, nerdy white guy who, you know, steps up to Gucci Mane and dares oppose him for, I guess, the turf of St. Petersburg or whatever. But I think it's working on that level, and I think it's really interesting that and James Franco is clearly more than game for it.
Yeah, a little too game for it, to be honest with you. I mean, you see what kind of what this guy's rolling with and what he's rolling in, literally, in his pad. He gives us a full tour, like you mentioned before, of like what all he's got.
Scarface on repeat.
On repeat, y'all.
This ain't even my bed. It's an art piece.
You know, and once he recruits these girls, and, you know, there's this sequence in it that's just what should be one of the dumbest things on earth becomes just one of the most incredible to me. Like, I just got lost in it. It involves a Britney Spears song.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah. Again, you talk about this whole fantasy aspect.
Right.
I mean, you're talking about girls hopping around in pink ski masks and neon green bikinis while holding machine guns up in the air. I mean, this isn't real life or anything like that. But to me, what it sort of represents is just this youth aggression, the extreme of where they can go in terms of their behavior and how their parents probably picture their kids when they're out partying. This is what they're getting into. This is the worst possible thing my little child could be doing right now. And while it can get pretty bad, it shouldn't get that bad. But, I mean, again, when poor decisions are made by these young people, it can take a turn for the worse like this. But, again, there are these youths out there, these young people who are too out of control, and there are people you can't control. There are a couple of characters in this who are just in it to win it. You know what I mean?
They're described at one point as demonic.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And they are. And that, I mean, I think that that, again, is something that Harmony Korine both embraces and is merely pointing out. This is great.
Yeah, I'm glad we're in agreement on this. This is my favorite film of the year so far.
Yeah, and it's going to take a lot to unseat it, to be honest.
Yeah, I you know, I'm open and willing for that to happen, but I don't disagree.
And quickly want to take issue with some of our colleagues, as it were, in the filmnerds.com and Aspect Radio universe here, because there are people who look at this movie and just write it off for whatever reason. And I think it's easy to do that based on who's in it, just because Selena Gomez or Vanessa Hudgens is in it. Harmony Korine at this point probably has a reputation people aren't totally fond of, and they look at this as just some ridiculous, again, sort of like bikini fantasy that is a two-hour music video. And to some extent, you can make an argument, well, yeah, okay, that might be what it is. But I think we're sitting here and arguing that there's so much to this movie, and there's so much more that you can get out of it other than the surface level stuff, which to me is entertaining in its own right. And I don't understand why people who care about movies would simply ignore this and write it off. This is what I would consider an important movie, especially the most, probably the most important movie of 2013, certainly so far.
Certainly so far.
Yeah, and it's going to have legs towards the end of the year. It's going to be something people are copying as filmmakers, and this is going to have the shelf life of so many cult classics out there. I guarantee you this movie is going to have legs beyond 2013. So it just dismays me and shocks me that anybody would just ignore this and let it just walk on by.
Well, you know, I understand some trepidation going into a movie like this, but it's not a movie that you think it's going to be, but it kind of is. I don't know. It's kind of, I mean, it's a movie that embraces its inherent, like, exploitative contradictions. It's not quite the movie you think when you hear about a movie about four girls in bikinis tearing up St. Petersburg, but it is that, but it's not.
and it's presented. It's all about presentation. You know, it's just, this is not something you should necessarily feel embarrassed or scuzzy about going to see.
And I'm sorry, but there are a worse way to spend 2 hours in a movie theater than watching Ashley Benson and Vanessa Hudgens and Selena Gomez frolicking around in bikinis for a couple hours.
Yeah, I felt worse about myself as a human being seeing two of the other movies we'll talk about than I did seeing Spring Breakers. I mean, just as an embrace of bad behavior and violence and nudity, at least it's presented with a conscience.
Yeah, and this is hard R, too.
Yeah.
I mean, there is nudity and violence galore in this movie, drug and alcohol use. But again, it works. It totally works. And yeah, I'm sure you probably felt really good about the decisions you've made in your life up to this point.
Up to this point, yeah. I felt validated that I never leave my room and go to parties.
And how old ever did you feel watching this movie, too? You know?
Well, consider it, like, one thing that did make me feel really old when you said the Skrillex track that we've all heard so many times at the beginning of mm-hmm. your review. That was the first time. That was literally the first time I'd ever heard it. And I didn't even know who this person, the Skrillex person, was.
And he gets composing credit on this movie, too.
Does he?
Yeah, he does. And I think he did do some original tracks for the soundtrack, but Cliff Martinez does this incredibly clever thing with the score where he sort of adapts the Skrillex song that we're talking about. It sort of becomes this motif in the movie that's used throughout, and it's really beautiful to me. I mean, Cliff Martinez, obviously, I've expressed how big a fan
he's great.
I am. Yeah, he did the Drive and Contagion scores and his work with Soderbergh before, but man, he does work here.
Yeah.
So Spring Breakers is playing in theaters in Alabama still this weekend. You're going to have to check Fandango, but it's leaving Tuscaloosa, unfortunately.
Yeah, check it out. It's not what you think it's going to be, unless you do think it's going to be the way it is.
And I'm sure there are probably some of you out there who do have Scarface on repeat and probably consider it one of your favorite action movies of all time. There are a few great action sequences in that of note anyway, but we're going to talk about our favorite action films. Before we get into that, let's talk about a couple of action movies that are out in theaters right now and sort of represent this modern action movie that we're seeing now. G.I. Joe Retaliation is one of them, the sequel to G.I. Joe, the big screen adaptation of yet another comic, or I'm sorry, toy line out there, as opposed to Transformers.
There were comics.
There were comics. There was a cartoon show, yeah, for sure. You liked the first G.I. Joe movie.
Yeah, I did.
And I didn't like it enough to see this one, even though I think it looks like a better movie, and I still might. But, I mean, you bring The Rock into it, and Channing Tatum has earned a speck of goodwill up to this point. On this show, anyway, I know you're a fan, but it looks like it has some fun action in it. Now, tell me a little bit about the second one, since I haven't seen it.
It doesn't have fun action, and it is not good. I mean, the thing is, like, I'm a fan of the first movie for my part because it embraces the goofy, and it goes over the top, and it basically plays to the sort of idea that, hey, this is a silly movie based on toys. We're going to have fun with it. It's going to be ridiculous. These people have names like Duke and the Duchess and Cobra Commander and Destro. And there's only so much. You can only take this so seriously. And we acknowledge and embrace that. So they're going to have like a crazy underwater secret lair and, you know, have ninjas sword fighting one another and whatnot. And they're going to have their mech suits and run through Paris and have themselves a fine time doing it. And I enjoyed it as this sort of very silly, very over-the-top action thing. Now, what G.I. Joe Retaliation does is say, okay, well, we're going to sort of try to reboot this G.I. Joe thing by making it grim and gritty. And basically, we're going to wipe all the Joes out and sever pretty much all of your connections to the first movie, and we're going to have The Rock, and he's going to be our protagonist, and Bruce Willis will show up acting like he's only there, you know, for 2 days and couldn't possibly care less about the material. And basically, they're just going to put on this sad, drab little modern action movie that just has no personality. Say what you will about the first movie, but there is this goofy personality there, courtesy of director Steven Sommers, who makes silly action movies like The Mummy and its sequel and Van Helsing. Now, I don't like, I mean, I think the first Mummy's pretty good, but most of his movies are, you know, garbage. But you can't really say that they're made without personality. This movie doesn't have one, and I fear, and we'll talk about this later, that's emblematic of the modern action movie as a whole. Furthermore, you've got these reasonably clever glimpses at this great cliffside ninja action scene in the trailers. That is literally the only action scene that is worth anything in this movie. Everything else is filmed in these like disorienting close-ups, again, in the style of the modern action movie. This movie looks like decidedly low rent, certainly more so than the first movie. It seems like it was obviously shot in Louisiana. The damn action climax seems to take place under a interstate overpass on the side of a river, which is bizarre to me that it's just as weirdly low-key as it is. But, I mean, it just feels low-budget, personality-less, bland, and boring. Well, and it's incomprehensible.
Some of these might be self-inflicted wounds, though, because of the production halt that it had.
But, see, I'm not sure what they reshot.
You can't really tell?
Well, the rumor was that they were reshooting the movie to include more of Channing Tatum's character. And I don't want to spoil anything, but that does not appear to be the case. If it had been, I would be a little bit more forgiving if, you know, not still negative. But the fact of the matter is, it just looks cheap throughout. And there's no real reason for it to. Because this is ostensibly a summer tentpole, or it was originally intended as a summer tentpole, before it was delayed to March for the ostensible reason of being converted to 3D. Well, I didn't see this in 3D, but I gotta assume that it would be even more of a visual mess and muddle than it already was with the added darkness and 3D thing.
Well, who doesn't want to see a G.I. Joe movie directed by the dude who did the Justin Bieber documentary?
Well, here's the damn thing. There is more visual invention in Step Up 3D than in the entirety of G.I. Joe Retaliation. Step Up 3D was actually kind of fun to see in theaters in 3D, and it has some really like well-composed dance sequences. There's nothing approaching the imagination of that movie in this, and it's baffling.
Olympus has fallen. Olympus has fallen.
Mr. Speaker, you are the acting president.
I want to speak for the Russians, the Chinese, the British, and the French, in that order.
If you attempt to retake this building, I will execute
your commander-in-chief.
Oh, my God.
We have contact from inside the White House.
Identify yourself.
309er.
Jesus, Banning?
Is this the same guy that was removed from the president's detail?
He is ex-Special Forces.
40 commandos breached the gate, 28 are left.
Can we trust him?
With all due respect, I'm the best hope you've got.
Well, let's talk about a movie you may or may not have had more fun at. You saw it today, and you saw it under difficult circumstances, right? Because you got the news that we addressed earlier in the show about. But I certainly had, surprisingly, a lot of fun at Olympus Has Fallen.
I had fun with it for about the first half of it, and then I think it pads its plot out a little too much for my liking in the second half. But again, in the second half, I was otherwise preoccupied, and the movie kind of lost me, probably not by its own fault. So I guess a grain of salt and all that. But for my part, I thought this was a better than average, fairly engaging piece of action work. You know, one thing that kind of troubled me a little bit, I mean, troubled on one level, I'll just say that so many modern action movies, whether they're PG-13 or rated R, feel like they were shot with the option to go either way. You know what I'm saying? Like, the kills and the blood and the violence that you get in these action movies are filmed as if they can be edited out without sort of affecting anything that happens in it. Well, that damn sure was not the case with Olympus Has Fallen, which seems to go out of its way to linger on every headshot and bullet wound and violent death that it depicts. And to a certain degree, like, you know, the first time this happens, the first action sequence, I'm like, yeah, far out, Roll Tide. You know, it goes on, though, and it's still cutting to headshots and, like, violent. And I'm just like, wow, they're really... Yeah. They're really lingering on this. They're really playing this up.
This is what I liked about it, though.
Yeah?
Yeah, it is, because you don't really get this R-rated, profane, hyper-violent action movie anymore.
It is hyper-violent.
This is like, honestly, this is like to me, an old school sort of 90s R-rated action movie.
Yeah, you're right.
B-movie, yeah. You know? And it's directed by Antoine Fuqua, who made Training Day, and he's made a few more of these B-movie action movies like Tears of the Sun, and he made Brooklyn's Finest was his last feature film, I think.
Shooter.
Really crappy B-movie Shooter with Mark Wahlberg. I didn't care for it. But this, though, I didn't really see it coming. My expectations for this were extremely low, so that probably really helped. But this is just one of those movies where it's like if you're at home like on a Friday night when you're like 12 years old and this comes on like USA or something, you're going to watch it. You're not going to get a lot out of it because you're not going to see like all the hardcore stuff that your, you know, cousins with HBO got to see and see without your parents' permission necessarily. But look, it's Die Hard in the White House. Really is what it is. You have this lone Secret Service agent who's loose in the White House after this North Korean and timely North Korean invasion. This movie might have even more to say than Spring Breakers.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, probably not. I think that's probably a pretty happy coincidence. But it reminds me of things like Executive Decision, the Kurt Russell movie about the, you know, the plane. Air Force One, absolutely. You know, we've gotten used to Gerard Butler at this point, who to me I think has kind of become a punchline of sorts. You know, when he makes movies like The Bounty Hunter and Playing for Keeps, this is Leonidas from 300 trying to like stuff himself into these harmless but probably even more harmful romantic comedies that don't do anybody any good, where he probably just wants to like date his co-star for a little while, and that's probably the only value anybody gets out of those. But this guy's an action star, and I think that Olympus Has Fallen shows us that this is him in his wheelhouse in these big, dumb, stupid movies, because we are seeing what he's good at and what we buy him as in movie form. Anyway, would you say that this is the kind of movie that you feel suits Gerard Butler better than anything?
I don't know about better than anything, but better than pretty much anything he's done so far. I mean, I think that some producer had the cute idea of taking Leonidas from 300 and casting him against type in a romantic comedy once. I don't know whichever one was the first one. And then every other movie producer somehow came up with that great idea, and it hasn't worked yet. Has not translated to any significant box office for anyone. So, yeah, him getting back to blowing stuff up and murdering people, yeah, seems like a good career move at this point. I don't think he's the strongest screen presence ever, but he suits this movie just fine. And this movie has a weirdly stacked cast too.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a 90s like Roland Emmerich movie, which is funny because Roland Emmerich has his own variation of the White House invasion movie coming out later this summer with our man Channing Tatum. But, you know, you've got Gerard Butler lurking around the White House and, you know, shooting people for a good amount of the runtime, and he's just fine with that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Aaron Eckhart, Melissa Leo pops up, Morgan Freeman is the Speaker of the House, Angela Bassett, Robert Forster is a general. So yeah, you're right, there's a pretty good cast here. I thought the villain was really weak, personally. Yeah. He didn't work for me at all. Was he in one of the Fast and the Furious movies, maybe?
I don't remember.
Or like maybe, he wasn't the Die Another Day guy, was he? The ice face guy. I don't know.
You know, maybe he was.
Yeah. But anyway,
that sounds about right.
It felt like his voice. Yeah, it was him, by the way.
Yeah.
It felt like his voice was dubbed at times. He just speaks in this very, like, stilted, just, like, sort of mean tone, and it just really comes across as, like, way more boring.
Yeah. He was pretty bland.
Totally.
But, you know, I'll support any action movie at least to a certain degree that gets people from the Raid work, because Mad Dog popped up in this.
Was that him?
That was him.
Okay. Yeah, because I saw a dude that looked kind of like Mad Dog.
I mean, if that was not, I didn't look this up to be sure, but if that was not him, and there are other like terrifying looking stringy haired martial arts badasses out there who can just snap your neck by looking at you, remind me not to piss one of them off.
Well, look, not to spend too much time on Olympus Has Fallen here, and let's talk about some of our favorite action movies. This isn't one of my favorite action movies.
This is a profoundly stupid movie.
It is, but this is the kind of action movie that needs to be out there. I mean, this isn't, like, this to me isn't like straight to video quality that we sometimes get in theaters.
Like G.I. Joe Retaliation.
Yeah, maybe like that.
Just like that.
You know, I just try to think of like, well, what do you want out of an action movie? Is it all about stunts and car chases and shootouts and fist fights? I mean, that plays a huge role in it. I mean, you need all of those things, but do you need Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, or some other badass action star who can pull all of that stuff off? for me personally, you definitely need all of those dumb, ridiculous things that could, you know, satisfy you on some level, but you also need a really sharp script too. And a lot of my favorite action movies happen to be extremely funny at the same time and have the, yeah, that star quality, but these stars who can pull off lines like that and make them work. I just kind of want to go down my list of favorite action movies here. But for me, sort of stepping out of the realm of American action movies, I think sort of the king of what makes great action movies go, for a while at least, was probably John Woo. Mm-hmm. And I think something that embodies all of that and has that star quality with Chow Yun Fat is Hard Boiled.
Yeah.
And it, to me, that is the ultimate action movie.
It's awesome.
It is. And that should be the only word that we need right. to describe these movies, to be honest with you.
When John Woo was on, I mean, he's pretty much unstoppable.
Yeah.
That was not Mad Dog, by the way, in Olympus Has Fallen. I don't even know. You know, give me a break here.
So, I mean, yeah. Yeah, you've got The Killer and Hard Boiled and some other great John Woo action movies. But yeah, Hard Boiled probably to me is like the quintessential thing because it has all those things I mentioned before. It's just a damn good time and it has enough stakes to keep you interested, but it's just badass. You know, you just want to sit there and just soak it in yeah. for as long as possible and revisit it. And just, even though you know every beat of every action scene and how it's choreographed, it's going to be just as, if not more badass the next time you watch it. And I think we got a glimpse of that at The Raid last year. You got that kind of action movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's in the discussion. But what would you say right now, looking back, is your favorite action movie of all time?
Well, I mean, the one that I've seen the most, and this doesn't really fit into the template of the modern action movie, so to speak, is Raiders of the Lost Ark, which I think, you know, the Indiana Jones movies kind of have to be in the conversation here as sort of throwback serial adventure stories. Raiders of the Lost Ark didn't really define what I think of as the template of the modern action movie, but it defined the language of modern action filmmaking for sure. And I don't think that anybody's really improved on what Steven Spielberg did there in the sort of breakneck, one calamity to the next pacing of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And the sequels, Temple of Doom and Last Crusade, are of varying but generally high quality as well. I had a dream once that we lived in an alternate universe where there was a fourth movie, but I don't think that I don't remember how that ended up.
Yeah, maybe one day.
But I think the movie that the sort of template of this modern genre is formed after, and still the one that nobody can quite catch up to is Die Hard.
Yeah.
The granddaddy of them all.
Yep.
And the reason for this is, you know, it got me thinking after I saw Olympus Has Fallen, and particularly after I saw A Good Day to Die Hard, of which Olympus Has Fallen is a far better Die Hard movie than A Good Day to Die Hard, which is bad. But Die Hard mixes so many elements with a sharp script and really memorable characters, from McClane down to tertiary characters like the FBI agents Johnson and Paul Gleason's police chief and Argyle, and like even the terrorists have distinct characters and personalities. It's not just, you know, an action movie populated by faceless extras. It's an action movie populated by people who you get to know organically through the events of the film. And, you know, as far as that goes, and as far as the sort of tension and twisty plot and action portrayed in the first Die Hard, you can't top it. You can chase it, you can recreate it, like the Die Hard sequels, like Under Siege, like, God, every action movie in the 90s tried to do. But you're not going to be able to top that, because there's some, it's like lightning in a bottle, for whatever reason.
What I love about Olympus Has Fallen, too, while we're on Die Hard, because it is Die Hard in a White House, is that it has that Ellis character in it, you know, who's like this dude that's sort of like hitting on Holly Gennaro and tries to negotiate with the terrorists and thinks he's won them over. Dylan McDermott sort of plays that role.
Yeah.
And Olympus Has Fallen is sort of like this scummy.
He's the Ellis.
Yeah, definitely. So I appreciated that. But I mean, just, you said all the right things. Die Hard probably is the ultimate action movie in the same way I think Hard Boiled is. I mean, you could say the same everything about Die Hard. But, you know, I look at James Cameron, even back when he was making good movies, you know, back in the 80s with Aliens, which I think is incredible and one of the best action movies ever. And True Lies, too. I mean, good God, that's all you could ever ask for in an action movie. And Terminator 2 here is on my list, too. So Cameron has really totally brought it. Raiders of the Lost Ark is on my list as well. Any of the good Indiana Jones movies, they bring it that way, too. I think Kill Bill Volume 1 has some of the best action that I'd seen in a long time.
Well, that's one thing I wanted to bring up. A lot of my favorite moments of action in recent film are not in what I would call action movies. You know, there's something about that. You can look at a movie like Looper, which I think has moments of really clever, well-constructed suspense and action scenes, and a movie like Django Unchained, which is not what I would call an action movie. Or even, I think, the finest moment of sustained action in film last year is in Zero Dark Thirty, and I don't think that's really even disputable, but I wouldn't call that an action movie by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, it's really hard, because a movie that's on my list is Fellowship of the Ring.
Right.
Which, it's an adventure film. It's right. A fantasy film, but it has so much great action in it.
It's like, how do you define, I guess, because when I think action movie or the action genre, I kind of think Die Hard clones or James Bond, or, you know, and there are a lot of great James Bond movies, too, that could make this list. Or, you know, just sort of grounded, I guess, gunplay. But when you look at it, I mean, I guess you've got the sword and sandals movies like Conan the Barbarian, and you've got, you know, your Lord of the Rings movies, and you've got your martial arts movies like, well, of which, you know, Kill Bill definitely fits into that as homage. So I guess the line is unclear there, but, you know, a lot of my favorite action movies are not traditionally action movies. You know, a lot of science fiction movies with action elements, like Aliens, like you said.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big one.
Oh, it's huge. It's huge. I mean, you got just like the log line of these movies, you know? Impress me with the log line. This team of space commandos or space marines goes on to a colony infested with deadly acid-spitting aliens just to wipe them out, and the tables turn. I want to watch that movie.
Yeah, for real. But then you've got like superhero movies, which are a genre unto themselves.
Yeah, but they're action movies.
Yeah.
Michael Bay is sort of like this face of action movies these days, unfortunately, because so many of his movies are terrible now.
You know which one's not? Bad Boys 2.
Well, which yeah, is okay. Awesome. I'll hear that out, and people would probably say that is the quintessential action movie today. But I would go back even further to The Rock in 1996.
Oh, The Rock is good too.
Great action movie. One of my favorites for sure. And again, you talk about the sharp script, the comedy that works in action. Action movies are surprisingly just such a great place for comedy. You wouldn't think so, but that to me, like Die Hard even, John McClane, you mentioned the memorable character. It's because he's hilarious. You know, This is a guy that you believe because of, you know, the way he talks primarily. It's just memorable that way. And you talk about war films too, like Saving Private Ryan, for instance. Would you feel bad about calling that an action movie? Because, I mean, you're sort of like stylizing the war and creating action set pieces, hyper-realistic action set pieces based on the war?
I don't know that I would feel bad about calling some war movies action movies. Saving Private Ryan is an interesting case, though, because I guess the scenes of war-related carnage in that movie are not meant to get the adrenaline pumping. I mean, they do.
They do, yeah.
That's and the thing.
It's awesome action. And somebody had to think of that, you know?
Right.
Like, I mean, we don't have, like, there's not necessarily, like, a blueprint for how it went down specifically.
Right.
We have stories told and, you know, documents in terms of historical reports that we have, but Spielberg had to choreograph that stuff.
You know, I kind of find that an interesting moral question.
Yeah.
You know, not whether or not that should be portrayed, but considering how it will be accepted by an audience. Saving Private Ryan, for whatever reason, is sort of canonized, and it's not the sort of movie that you would go see in a theater and, you know, cheer and pump your fist at, you know, when, well, not at least not the Normandy beach scene.
No, not necessarily, but, you know, when they make it through,
right,
then you're feeling good about it.
Yeah.
Or when Barry Pepper shoots another sniper through the scope
yeah,
in
that's
the eye,
awesome.
That's when you pump your fist and say, yeah, America, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And so it works that way. But then, you know, science fiction action movies, the Star Wars movies are great action movies. Return of the Jedi has some of the best action ever. Speed is one of the greatest action movies ever.
Speed's good.
It's incredible. I'm just going to read off my honorable mentions.
Go for
here.
It.
I just want to talk. You know, I have a soft spot for this, and we're not talking Michael Bay here, but the 1986 Transformers, the movie, animated movie, one of my favorite movies of all time. Killer action in that. I'm going to go back way back when I was taking one of my TCF classes here at the University of Alabama. Tarzan and His Mate got to watch one of those early Tarzan movies.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
got some great action in it. Both King Kong movies are great. Predator, Jurassic Park, The Matrix, The Killer, which I mentioned before. The third Die Hard movie, Die Hard with a Vengeance, might be as good as the first Die Hard movie.
I don't know about that.
Ooh.
It's good, but
Braveheart,
The Lethal Weapon movies, throw all of them in there. Mm-hmm. Heat has one of the greatest action sequences ever in that bank robbing sequence. Sergio Leone's films, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yeah, I mean, Westerns onto themselves might be... I mean, that's a separate discussion.
Sort of a subgenre of action movies.
Yeah, I'd say so. And Leone, particularly in The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, really knows his stuff there.
Well, and before The Raid, and I would hear out Dread, too, from last year. Dread's I was awesome. Trying to think, like, what was the last great action movie? And... it took me a while to think about it, and I remember thinking about this a few years ago, and I would go to 2004, The Incredibles.
Yeah.
Incredible action. And then you go all the way to Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which was another great action movie, yeah, which Brad Bird also made. So he might be one of our best action filmmakers now.
Yeah, I wish I had had time to sit down and make a list. You've got movies like, I don't know, I mean, I don't know that I'd classify this as an action movie necessarily, but The Hurt Locker.
Yeah. It's a thriller. I mean, I would hear out action. Yeah. I mean, I've never felt as tense during some action movies as I do.
I'd entertain that argument, too.
I mean, what about Christopher Nolan's movies?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much all to a point.
Yeah.
After, well, not The Prestige necessarily, but the Batman movies and Inception, certainly. Mm-hmm. True Grit is a great one. Mm-hmm. The Coen Brothers version. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but again, it's like, it just depends on how you're defining the genre, because... I don't know. I think Die Hard. I think Die Hard clones. I think gunplay of, I don't know, a more contemporary sort for whatever reason. And you know, I it's not necessarily to limit the genre, because you're right. A lot of these do have action elements. I don't know. Just about classification, I guess.
Okay. Well, we'd love to hear, you know, some of our friends' favorite action movies, too. Please let us know. Tweet at us at Aspect Radio. We'd love to hear it. Let's quickly run through what... is that on DVD this week or nothing. Coming up?
Coming up. Also, this is a slow month.
This was a horrible week.
Yeah, you had the Don Coscarelli movie, John Dies at the End, which is the only significant release, but I didn't like that very much. Next week is the Bill Murray starring Hyde Park on Hudson. I didn't like that very much. The week after that, Django Unchained, and not much else. So this is a good month to not buy DVDs or Blu-rays, just catch up on some of those classics you missed, maybe some stuff that's already out you haven't gotten around to see.
Well, the Red Dawn remake came out, right?
Oh, God.
That's an action movie people can check out.
That is.
I'm just saying it exists.
It does exist, but it's kind of a slow home video release month. Hopefully it'll kick back up soon.
And so that's it?
Yeah, slim pickings.
Oh, well. Yeah. Well, we would encourage people to go listen to Cinematrimony on filmnerds.com and just visit that site. We want to thank the filmnerds.com and Aspect Radio contributors for their thoughts on Roger Ebert and reiterate how much we're really going to miss that guy.
Oh, we have an announcement. We're both on Critic Wire now.
Oh, yeah. It's been that long.
Yeah.
Hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So...
so check us out on Critic Wire.
Yeah, I guess
it's part
of
the IndieWire network.
You know, let's mention this too, that they just asked us to participate, or anybody who's on Critic Wire, to participate in this Spielberg survey.
Yeah.
And you can go and find out what people think are the top five Spielberg films, screenplays, scores, shots, performances, heroes, villains. There are a ton of categories.
I didn't get a chance to fill it out completely.
Yeah.
It's pretty involved, but I got most of the categories filled out.
So it's kind of fascinating to see what people think. Yeah. And the fact that people thought that Hook was overall a worse movie than Kingdom of the Crystal Skull makes me feel bad about humanity.
I kind of disagree with that, but I don't like Hook either.
It's no Crystal Skull.
It's no Crystal. You're right. It's no Crystal Skull.
No.
But it's not good.
Well, anyway, I disagree. I think Hook's pretty awesome, personally, but that's just me. So, yeah, go to filmnerds.com, listen to Cinematrimony, visit, follow Matt Scalici, GFMMI, Citizen _ Craig, Wondermill Films. Follow us on Twitter. This has been Flanagan. Yeah. 7 8.
It's my name
9
backwards.
0.
It's my name backwards, followed by the last four numbers on your damn keyboard. So it's really not as difficult to understand or remember as you might think.
We want to say thanks to Andrew Richardson, our producer.
Yeah, props.
Producing and whatnot. And we are now at aspectradioshow.com, and you can just find us via Tumblr and on iTunes as well.
AspectRadio.com has like some sharks or something on it now and a lot of characters I don't understand.
Yeah.
Somebody snapped that right up. It's valuable property.
They're holding it hostage.
Yeah.
So anyway, but we do really appreciate it. And until next time, I'm Ben Flanagan.
And I'm Corey Kraft. This is Aspect Radio. Thanks for listening.
That's it for this special show. Next week, we'll be back with our annual memo to the Academy. And that's next week. Until then, the balcony is closed.
rent a movie in 1996? Then you'll want the brand new 1996 edition of Roger Ebert's Video Companion. It comes with a separate pocket video guide.